Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The United States surpasses 60,000 deaths as the economy contracts at its steepest rate since the financial collapse of 2008. Then, how secure is the food supply? A look at the meatpacking industry and the cracks that are beginning to show in American agriculture. Plus, medicines for COVID. What to make of potentially hopeful signs for a treatment? While questions remain about the accuracy of tests for antibodies to neutralize the virus. And the added challenges of serving students with special needs when the classroom becomes the home. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A medicine to treat COVID-19 and speed recovery from it is making headlines tonight. That development comes as U.S. deaths from COVID have reached 60,000, exceeding the 58,000 killed in the Vietnam War. And economic growth in this country has suffered its sharpest collapse in a dozen years. Stephanie Tsai has our lead report.
A glimmer of hopeful news today in the battle to contain COVID-19. The National Institutes of Health reported positive results from an international study on the experimental drug remdesivir, made by the biotech firm Gilead. The NIH's Dr. Anthony Fauci voiced hope at the White House.
The data shows that remdesivir has a clear-cut, significant, positive effect in diminishing the time to recovery.
The study among hospitalized patients showed those who took the drug had a 31% faster recovery time. The Food and Drug Administration said it is moving to make remdesivir available to patients as soon as possible. But on the economic front, hope was harder to find. The pandemic has now officially stopped the U.S. economy's longest expansion on record. The nation's output of goods and services shrank at an annual rate of 4.8% in the first quarter. And as White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow acknowledged, that's just the beginning.
The next quarter is going to be much worse. But, you know, you close the economy down for 2 months plus, and you know, we've done everything we can to provide liquidity and cash assistance and protect workers.
A new PBS NewsHour NPR Marist poll finds that 50% of Americans have been laid off or have a household member who has either lost a job or had their hours cut. Just today, Boeing announced it will cut 10% of its workforce. In another bid to shore things up, the Federal Reserve announced it will keep a key interest rate near zero for the foreseeable future. Chairman Jerome Powell.
You know, what we're trying to assure, really, is that the market is working. The market is assessing risks. Lenders are lending, borrowers are borrowing.
The nation's food supply chain is also under new scrutiny. President Trump last night signed an executive order telling meatpacking plants to remain open. At least 17 plants have suspended operations in recent weeks due to coronavirus outbreaks among workers. Unions quickly criticized the president's order. But in the Oval Office today, President Trump pushed back, saying workers will be kept safe.
They're going to be very careful, they are, as to who's going into the plant. And the quarantine is going to be very strong. And we're going to make people better when they have a problem.
More states are starting to loosen lockdowns, allowing retailers and restaurants to open as they try to reassure returning customers.
So you should feel comfortable to come into the Cleburne and sit down and enjoy your meal like you did in the old days.
This Houston restaurant is providing hand sanitizer and taking customers' temperatures. But in areas that were hot spots, officials like New York Governor Andrew Cuomo again counseled caution.
Make the decisions on the facts. Make the decisions on the numbers. You can reopen if you don't increase hospitalizations and you don't increase the infection rate.
In Europe, COVID-19 spread across the continent has led to a slow start to a usually busy tourism season. In hard-hit Italy, a beachfront near Naples is deserted as hotels and beaches remain closed. And Greece's Corfu Island is bracing for the worst.
We don't know if our hotels will open, when will they open, so We're right now in the brink of very hard times.
In Germany today, officials extended a travel warning until mid-June, despite protests from industry groups. And in Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe warned that the already postponed Tokyo Summer Olympics may not be held next year either, unless there is a COVID-19 vaccine by then. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Wall Street surged today on hopes for a major medical advance in the pandemic. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 532 points to close at 24,663. The NASDAQ rose 307 points, 3.5%, and the S&P 500 was up 76. Now, the latest information on treating COVID-19 and finding ways to tell who's been infected. As plans grow to reopen the economy, one key prerequisite will be testing for antibodies to see who has already been exposed and theoretically safe from further infection. There's now a flood of new tests on the market, but not without controversy. We're going to look at that as well as at something else, an antiviral drug that was just today approved for emergency use. Our science correspondent Miles O'Brien is here to help us sort things out. It's part of our regular look at the leading edge of science and research. So, Miles, let's first look at this drug that was approved today to treat COVID-19. What are we hearing about it?
Well, Judy, the drug is called remdesivir, the first documented COVID-19 patient in the United States. In the Seattle area in January, was infused with it. And that patient, who at the time was failing fast, had pneumonia, had a very abrupt turnabout for the good, and was released from the hospital only a few days later. Now, the details of the study announced today bear that anecdotal story out. It suggests that COVID-19 patients who are infused with remdesivir can be released as soon as 4 days earlier. Now, the doctor who treated patient number one, Dr. George Diaz, at the Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett, spoke to us just a little while ago, and he said, this is making us more optimistic that we're headed down the right path here with remdesivir.
But, Miles, this is not the end of it. More studies to be done. I mean, there's a lot of work still being done on this drug, aren't there?
It's literally global. It's a global study, multiple locations. But now that there is news that the drug can, in fact, block the progress of the virus, it changes the rule of the study. It allows them to remove the placebo patients. In other words, everybody will now get the drug to see if there's some effect. We still don't know if remdesivir changes the mortality rate, if fewer people die. That's still under review. There was a study in China earlier on in this whole pandemic that involved that particular issue, but it didn't come to any conclusion on that. It was a flawed study. Only half of the subjects that they wanted to test were involved in the study, and those subjects were sicker. So it's kind of a muddied study right now. So there's still more to be done here.
So now let's turn the corner and talk about this antibody testing. Now, this is something different from the testing as to whether you actively have COVID-19 right now, where we think about the swab. This is different, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of a question of tense. If you want to know if somebody in the moment has the coronavirus present in their system, the way to do that is a genetic test. Look for the genetic fingerprint of the virus itself. But if you want to find out if somebody had it in the past, the way to do that is to go with an antibody test.
Antibodies are the foot soldiers of our immune system. They are proteins created by white blood cells that are specifically tailored to identify and help attack invaders. Most of us have all kinds of antibodies in our system to help ward off a whole host of infections. Of course, the problem with this novel coronavirus is it gets free rein, no antibodies to stop it. But when our immune system figures out what the threat looks like, our white blood cells get busy producing new antivirus foot soldiers, antibodies to the rescue. They are tailor-made like puzzle pieces to attach to the new invader and hopefully protect from it. In essence, a test puts a piece of the virus in contact with some blood. If the blood contains the antibodies designed to fight the novel coronavirus, they will be activated, causing a detectable chemical reaction.
And Miles, how do they know they're testing for the right antibody? This is a newly discovered virus. We're hearing a lot about a high rate of inaccuracy.
Yeah, it's complicated science to say the least, and it's on an urgent deadline. Having a test that can pick out the right type of antibody in the sea of other antibodies is the key. Scientists at the University of California, San Francisco, and UC Berkeley have started testing all these antibody tests, which are appearing on the market like mushrooms. None of the dozen tests, and I repeat this, none of the tests that they have looked at and evaluated make the grade. There are all kinds of false positives and false negatives.
And Miles, that is so discouraging to hear, because we know in order to make a lot of progress toward ending this shutdown, stay at home, social distancing, we're going to have to know a lot more about who's been exposed and who isn't contagious anymore.
Yeah, I mean, the one good thing about these tests, once we find accurate ones, is it helps us understand how widespread the virus is. That's one thing. But we all want to get back to work, and we all want to know who's got immunity, who's safe to go back to work. But that's a much bigger challenge, because scientists can't say that even if they find those antibodies that are telltale, if those particular antibodies are protective. So it even gets more complicated. So there's no way to determine right now if anyone has any immunity to SARS-CoV-2. We spoke with immunologist Alex Marson, who is at UCSF and part of the UC Berkeley team as well.
Having a test that will tell us easily who's protected from reinfection, it's all of our hopes. There's a lot of work ahead to be done. But one message I want to get out there very, very clearly, none of these tests should currently give anyone a feeling that they're safe from reinfection and modify their behavior to take on more risk. We're just not there yet.
So those are really important words from the scientists. We hope everybody takes those to heart. You know, scientists say the experience we've had historically with other coronaviruses, and after all, the common cold is a coronavirus, indicate that we should get immunity. That's just the way it generally goes. But as you pointed out, this is all new turf, and so none of that is proven. It's hopeful that it will happen. There's no one that thinks it will be different this time, but science still has to bear this out, Judy.
So much work being done and so much work yet to be done. Miles O'Brien bringing us up to date. Miles, we thank you.
You're welcome, Judy.
In the day's other news, the U.S. government's Small Business Administration reserved 8 hours until midnight for small banks to submit coronavirus relief loans for their customers. It is part of the Paycheck Protection Program. There's been intense criticism that community lenders and their small business clients have been pushed aside in the process. The U.S. Navy today widened its investigation of the COVID-19 outbreak aboard the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt. In a statement, the acting Navy Secretary, James McPherson, cited unanswered questions that he said need a deeper review. The announcement delays any reinstatement of Brett Crozier as the carrier's captain. He was fired after pleading for his crew to be evacuated. In the presidential race, the presumptive Democratic nominee, Joe Biden, has won Ohio's primary. Thursday's vote had been scheduled for mid-March, but was delayed by the COVID-19 pandemic. Most of the voting was done by mail. And the governing body for college sports, the NCAA, is moving ahead with a plan to let athletes earn money from acts such as endorsing products or selling autographs. The organization's board of governors backed the rule change today. That paves the way for member schools to vote next January. We'll discuss the implications later in the program. Still to come on the NewsHour, the American meat industry in a moment of crisis as COVID-19 hits the processing plants. The vulnerability of special needs students as millions of children are forced to learn from home. Plus, much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour. from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West, from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
We're going to focus now on the questions around meat processing plants, worker safety, and the food supply. While President Trump has signed an executive order to keep the plants open, a number of processing facilities remain closed. In Minnesota, a pork plant did reopen today, briefly, not to resume processing hogs, but to euthanize a growing surplus of animals. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro begins our look with a report on how this is playing out for farmers.
It's spring planting time in southern Minnesota. Soon, these vast prairies will sprout soybeans and corn destined for markets around the world. But the largest of consumers they will feed are not human and not far away. Minnesota and neighboring Iowa are among the largest pork-producing regions in the world. Mike Patterson's family has been doing this for multiple generations. They are part of an elaborate food chain that ends, in this case, at the Smithfield plant 200 miles away in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Like more than two dozen meatpacking facilities that have seen closure across the country, this one's been shuttered since April 11th after a COVID-19 outbreak. So has another nearby pork plant, JBS, in Worthington, Minnesota. Patterson says he's looking at staggering losses.
If we weren't able to harvest any of the hogs on our farm, we're looking at probably $450,000. And we're not a big operation.
This barn is one of three on the Patterson farm. It holds about 1,000 animals. And it's here that you get a sense of the scale of the industry that they're part of. The Smithfield plant in South Dakota, to where these pigs would normally go, takes in 20,000 pigs each day.
I don't think I appreciated the efficiency of the whole system. And when one piece of that system goes down, you know, I knew it, but I maybe didn't appreciate it as much.
While plant workers continue to receive 80% of their wages during the shutdown, it's hundreds of hog farmers like Patterson who say they stand to lose the most. Animals are brought to these so-called finishing barns from nurseries. Here they are raised over 16 to 20 weeks to a nearly exact weight required by the packing houses like Smithfield. As they're moved out, a new batch of young animals is ready to take their place.
Obviously, those barns aren't empty, so where do those pigs go?
So you have some ugly options.
Definitely. I know in the industry there's been talk of euthanasia, of swine or depopulation, of harvest-ready hogs. That's something that we as farmers just absolutely, we don't want it to happen.
A couple of hours away, the much smaller Sobosinski farm has just about 300 pigs, whose owner says they're really thriving.
Give the animals a little bit more freedom to move about.
Paul Sobosinski decided two decades ago to scale back from what he calls the industrialized system that now produces much of the nation's meat.
Has it been the right decision financially?
This isn't perfect, but overall it's been a good decision.
His animals are processed at a small nearby slaughterhouse where no one has tested positive for COVID-19. The meat is sold through a national network of independent producers called Neiman's Ranch. Sobosinski has long been an activist against a system that he says has concentrated power and profit in a few corporate hands at the expense of both laborers and farmers.
Beef prices went down substantially because of the coronavirus. Who's grabbing all that money? Has food come down in the grocery store? No, it hasn't. I think it's important that we retool what we're doing out here. We need more local processing, so more of that's done here in the community. It helps build the community.
For Patterson, however, it boils down to keeping pork prices as low as possible.
I understand that local piece of it, and I appreciate that, but how do we feed the masses and do it cheaply? You can't do that on a smaller scale. You need the efficiencies of size and scale to be able to get that done.
The debate is not new and may well return post-COVID-19. Just how much are American consumers willing to pay for their food, and has the pandemic changed attitudes? But more immediately, Patterson and hundreds of fellow hog farmers are watching anxiously for word on when the two mega factories can reopen, tweaking the diet of their animals to slow their weight gain.
We've maybe bought a week to 10 days, trying everything we can to slow them down.
When the plants do reopen, however, workers could be farther apart on the production line to prevent the spread of COVID-19. That would slow down the line, which in turn would mean fewer animals at the plant and more, Patterson says, in his barns with nowhere to go. For the PBS NewsHour, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in Kenyon, Minnesota.
Fred's reporting is a partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. William Brangham explores a number of questions we just heard raised.
And for that, I am joined by Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media. Amy, thanks for being on the NewsHour again. President Trump said meatpacking plants and meat processing plants are part of the country's critical infrastructure. What does his executive order mean? What do we know?
It means that these plants are expected to stay open. It means they fall into a category of employer that has certain responsibilities, but also certain privileges for staying open. There are some unknowns. The plants obviously have to prioritize worker safety and their employees' health and well-being, but it does give them the obligation, but also the opportunity to stay open and have, you know, the force of the federal government behind them in that decision.
But it's not totally clear if the government could, if say one plant or one company was resistant to doing so. It's not clear if the federal government has the authority to force them to do so.
It's the reopening that seems unclear. There are some plants that are currently closed because of outbreaks of COVID-19. Most of those companies would prefer to be open. They've either closed because of just the sheer number of cases, or in some cases, pressure from local and state governments. With this federal order, certainly there wouldn't, the local and federal state governments would not be able to pressure them to close because they would have this federal mandate to be open. What remains a little bit unclear right now is for those ones that are currently in closure, will they have to speed up their reopenings because of the order?
And we know that Tyson Foods, one of the major meat manufacturers in the country, warned that there might be millions and millions of pounds of meat that basically drops out of that supply chain. Do you have a sense of the impact this might have on consumers? I mean, theoretically, that's what the president is acting on behalf of, to keep a steady supply of food in stores.
That's right. I've heard some conflicting things about what the impact on consumers could be. We hear large numbers from the meat plants. I don't think consumers really have a sense of how much meat goes out in a day anyway. So what might be lost is sort of a difficult number to process. We do know, for example, that there's millions of pounds of meat in cold storage. It's not the types of meat that perhaps we're most accustomed to buying at the grocery store. It may be more processed meat or cuts that normally are sent to export markets. But there's that. There was also a large redirection of meat that was already in the supply chain because it's no longer going to restaurants and institutional settings. A lot of that the government is buying to send to food banks and for other people in need. Some of that could get diverted to the retail sector. There could be shortages, and in some communities, people at their grocery stores have already seen meat cases emptying more quickly than usual. Of course, part of that is also shopper behavior. We're going to the store less often, so we're buying more when we go.
We know, as we were saying, thousands of workers at different plants have gotten sick. And if they're forced to reopen, there's talk of, can this work be done in a way where there is more social distancing or where workers can wear protective gear? Do you know whether that's possible? Can you run a modern meat processing facility and protect workers from a virus like this?
It's becoming increasingly clear to me that you cannot run the plant at your usual full capacity and meet the social distancing and other requirements to prevent virus spread. For example, I heard a worker describe today being on the break line in a beef plant. That's literally where workers are taking halves of cattle and then cutting them into smaller pieces, and then they get moved along to be made into the sorts of cuts we might recognize. He said in that environment, workers are typically 1.5 to 2 feet away from each other, working hard physically constantly all day at chilled room temperatures. So they're sweating because they're working hard, but they're breathing into these face shields they've been given, which then causes fogging so they can't see. So it's really not practical to work in that PPE, which is so necessary. You can see the domino effect here. But to change your operation so that those workers could be 6 feet apart would mean to process fewer animals than you would expect to process. So these are decisions that the plants are going to have to evaluate. But if they can't shut down to rearrange their work structures, I don't see how they ever get to a point where they could implement these really dramatic changes in the workplace situation. On the other hand, there are lines where companies have been able to put up plexiglass shields between workers. That's obviously something that can help, especially when the workers are sitting side by side, but that could provide some protection.
All right. Amy Mayer of Iowa Public Radio and Harvest Public Media, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
In the U.S., roughly 14% of students enrolled in public school receive special education services. As families across the nation are grappling with how to teach their students from home, we wanted to look at the particular challenges parents of these students are facing. Here's what we heard.
My name is Erin Croyle. I live in Ithaca, New York. I have three children. I have a 9-year-old who has Down syndrome and ADHD and some other medical complexities that make it really, really difficult right now. My son, my oldest, requires a team of anywhere between 3 to 10 people at a time to help him learn. He's refusing to work. He's refusing to do any of the materials.
My name is Trisha Bermudez, and I live in Arver, New York, which is on the Rockaway Peninsula. And my son is Matthew. He is 7, and he was born with a rare chromosome deletion. So that puts him under a unique umbrella in the special education world, because he has one of his diagnoses is learning disability and global developmental delay. For me, it's more about his regression and what that looks like, and how much more work he will need once we come out of this pandemic.
My name is Angela Franco. I live in Rockville, Maryland. My son is Matthew Gulick. He's 11 years old. He has attended a special education program since he was 5 years old. I'm doing my best to keep it at home. You know, it's obviously not the same being at the school with a schedule, you know, with somebody that is not necessarily the parent, that is an outsider, that can be more objective.
My name is Corinne Raisler. I live in San Carlos, California, and I teach 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders with mild to moderate disabilities. The assignments are relatively similar to what we were doing in the classroom, but dialed back a little bit. We've been told that we don't have to be teaching anything new.
I'm David Perry. I live in Shoreview, Minnesota, which is a suburb just north of the Twin Cities. And my son is 13. He's one of two kids. My daughter is 10. He has Down syndrome and is autistic. He's, I guess, what the professionals call functionally nonverbal. And we try to do the assignments that we can do, and we look for the ones that are well adapted and that seem to make sense. And we let a lot of things go, and we are letting a lot of things slide.
I try to do a schedule, and I try to get something to happen every day, and every day I feel like a failure. And I get emotional because I care so deeply about his education, but it's not possible.
For physical therapy, literally, I'm having to hold his arms to make sure he extends them, kind of coaching him on the other end of some things to kind of go on, but he's distracted, you know, because we're at home.
They're doing things online, but I put together like a mini maker in my house. So he has the tools, he has the glue, he has the screwdriver.
I used two pieces of wood.
So one day he came out with a trash picker that he made with a shoebox and a piece of wood. So he cut it and he put it on top of the shoebox. and I think look amazing. I was like, wow, I'm impressed with my son.
Thanks to Kid Museum, I made this.
He often requires a set of highly specific and intensive supports. I am not a trained special ed teacher. I'm not trained in providing him those supports. And if what I did all day was just sit with him and work on education, I think we could really accomplish a lot. But I'm not able to do that because I'm working from home.
I tell them every day that if they ever want to talk to me, that they can message me on the classroom and then we can have a one-on-one conversation. And I have done that with a student who was feeling very anxious and worried. And we talked about how she was feeling, and she was very sad that we weren't coming back to school.
This is much bigger than just saying, let's open schools. What does that game plan look like for our kids? And the plan that comes out of this needs to include our children aggressively.
We've been home for a month, and I think maybe I have sat him down and gotten him to engage maybe 3 times. And it's a little bit heartbreaking, but it also is, I just chalk it up to a win, because you got to take what you can get and hoping that that will lead to more success.
Heartwarming and hard to hear at the same time. And we want to dig a little deeper into the challenges facing families with special needs students right now with Celine Almazan. She is the legal director for the Council of Parent Attorneys and Advocates. It's a nonprofit that aims to protect the legal and civil rights of children with disabilities. Celine Almazan, thank you very much. You've been doing this work for, what, more than 30 years. And you were telling us that one of the hardest things about what's going on right now is what these children are losing by not being in the classroom.
Yes, it's heartbreaking to listen to those families try to do what schools do every day with students with disabilities. So it really is heartbreaking. And I don't know what I would do being in their situation. Students with disabilities are losing out an enormous amount right now during this pandemic. And it is difficult to hear their struggles.
You pay a lot of attention to what school districts, what schools are required to do. Tell us just in general, what are schools required to do in working with these children? And then how is it different now that these children are out of the class?
Well, schools are required to provide a free, appropriate public education to children so they can make progress in their academic educational environment. They're supposed to address their the needs that the disabilities present, whether that's through academic, reading, writing, math. Other students need speech therapy, physical therapy, occupational therapy. And some students need more than what public schools can offer them and require private placement at public expense. And those are special education schools. So schools throughout the country pre-pandemic are providing many children with an appropriate education. The concern that we have had since the beginning of the school closures was what are schools going to do to address the needs of children with disabilities.
And realistically, how much of what these children were getting in the classroom? We heard one mother say her son requires anywhere from 3 to 10 people to work with him. How much of that can parents be realistically expected to do?
Well, I think it's hard because parents are also trying to work from home if they remain employed. So that's a plus that you're still employed. But it is difficult for families. Schools need to start where the IEP is, the Individualized Education Program, which is the roadmap that schools have to follow in order to educate a child. Many schools have implemented the distance learning plans. Those distance learning plans need to look at the goals on the IEP and continue to work on some of those goals in the distance learning plan. So if a child has needs in reading, if a child has needs in math, they should continue to address those needs through the distance learning plan. If a child has speech language needs and needs speech and language therapy, then that needs to be addressed. I think one of the mothers said that her child was receiving physical therapy electronically, but it requires her to manipulate his arms in order to participate in the physical therapy. And it is a lot for families. It is a lot.
We heard one of the mothers say she feels like a failure. What is your advice to parents who are watching this, listening to this, and feeling that this is more than they are capable of doing?
Well, from the outset, COPA has encouraged people to work together with their school districts. We're sort of all in this together, but also we've advised families to look at where a child was the day before school closed. What was the child able to do then academically or with their speech or with physical therapy? What was the child able to do? And then keep track either through video, either through data collection, either through looking at the assignments the child was able to complete pre-closure, what the child is able to complete during the closure instruction, and document that so that when schools resume, they can come to the school and say, my child has regressed, or my child has lost these skills, and this is where my child is now. We need to look at where he is now and start to program for him going forward, either by revising the IEP, by looking at new evaluations to see where a child is presently when they come back to school. It's hard when you're a parent of a child with a disability. I know that from my own experience. And what I do tell families is you just got to look at where you are on that day. And then tomorrow is another day. What parents of children with disabilities know, what we know as parents of children with that have needs, is that every day is a new day. We also know that we have to work really hard at documenting for schools so that schools will know exactly what a child is going to need. Parents are a child's biggest advocate. You know your child the best. And the only thing that you can do between now and when school starts is continue to document what a child is doing now, what they were able to do before, so that when school reconvenes, you can give that information to the school.
Good advice. I am sure for all these parents, we all need to give them as much support as we possibly can. Celine Almazan, joining us from Maryland, thank you very much.
Thank you.
College athletics may be suspended right now, but when sports resume a more regular routine, football and basketball remain big business with billions of dollars at stake. There has long been a debate over whether athletes should be compensated in some right or better able to access money made through these sports. The NCAA opened the door to a significant change on that front today. Amna Nawaz is here with more.
Judy, the NCAA's Board of Governors will finally allow college athletes to earn money from endorsements and to cash in on business made from their names, image, and likeness. But schools and athletic conferences won't be a part of it, and there will be no pay-for-play arrangement. I'm joined now by Len Elmore, former college and NBA basketball player. He's also a member of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics, which supports the educational mission of college sports. Len Elmore, welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks for being with us. And let's just start with the decision today. What was your reaction to this latest step from the NCAA?
Well, I was very pleased to see that the NCAA is kind of ushering in a new era for college sports. I mean, in the era where student athletes can be treated fairly, they have an opportunity to be able to capitalize on their name, image, and likeness, which is a natural right. It's something that can't be abrogated by any administrative body. And certainly if they want to give it an opportunity, they should be compensated. It's different from pay for play.
So help us understand the details, because even the NCAA said this is uncharted territory. If a player, say, wants to do an autograph signing for money or gets a brand deal on Instagram, that's okay. But does this mean Nike can now sponsor a college athlete, or a local business in your college town can pay you to put you on a billboard?
Well, I'm not sure that those details have been expressly fleshed out, but essentially that's the idea, to be able to capitalize on who you are as a college athlete, which was heretofore forbidden. However, there are some guardrails to help keep athletes from being exploited, as well as making sure that you know, there's no under the table types of payments made. For instance, institutions can't be involved in any endorsement deal, nor can they generate the endorsement deals for student athletes. However, again, the student athletes can't, you know, they, in some instances, they can't represent sponsors that are already sponsoring the institution. And, you know, that's where we have state laws that have been kind of inconsistent on that front.
So institutions can't get in on the deal, but for example, say there's a a college athlete who has already influence from an agent, right? We know that there's corruption at every level. Agents get involved even at the high school level in some cases, certainly at the college level. Are you worried that this opens the door for even more exploitation from those influences that are already part of the system?
Well, I think allowing agents involved is something that the NCAA is still discussing, their Board of Governors. I personally don't believe that it's a good idea for that very reason. They allow marketing agents to help generate opportunities for student athletes, but, you know, then they say you can't be involved in pursuing professional opportunities. Well, good luck with that, because once agents are involved, they're going after the most lucrative opportunities there are, and that would be in essentially from a pro-opportunity and situation, and agents are very, very loath to let go of a client once they have a hold of them.
So, Len, the NCAA rules were put into place to prioritize education, but we already know in a lot of cases, especially with the top athletes, a lot of them go one and done, right? They use college to propel them into the pros. When you have big dollar sports making millions off these kids, what's the best argument you have for not just compensating them?
Well, again, playing college sports is absolutely a privilege, not a right. And there are many choices out there if the intention is to make money for playing basketball. And the increased interest in international sports as well as playing in the G League, the NBA's G League, provides more options for young people who go to college simply to become eligible for the draft. And I think that it's a fair trade-off. Once you sign on the dotted line to play college sports, you are now saying you're going to play within the regulations that are provided. And if you don't want to do that, now you have an opportunity to make a choice to go someplace else. And honestly, I think it's fair.
That is Len Elmore, the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics, joining us tonight. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
On our bookshelf tonight, battling loneliness and how we can come out of this pandemic more connected to each other.
Judy, the social distancing we've been asked to practice to try to slow the spread of the virus has led to feelings of social isolation and loneliness for some people. Here's what some viewers told us about their experiences.
I can't work from home, but my coworkers can and do. So at any given time, I'm the only person at work. There are entire days when I don't speak because there's no one to talk to. I really miss having my coworkers around and being able to ask them questions or talk about random things when we all need a break or sitting down to have lunch with them. It's pretty lonely when it's just you at your desk. I understand why it's necessary to social distance, and I completely support that because the science behind it says that it helps. And I'm a scientist, so I definitely understand that, but it's been rough.
I'm an introvert. I enjoy being alone and things like that. However, this being isolated from the real world, being able to go and visit friends and family in social settings, going to a restaurant, share a meal or a movie, has affected me more than I thought it would, actually. That being said, I miss the personal interaction. You get more of an interaction with people when you see them, you know, face to face. So not being able to see someone smirk or smile or if their eyebrows are furrowed or things like that, you just don't get the same connection.
So even though I get to talk with people virtually more, at times I really do feel emptier than before.
I really didn't realize how much just a simple interaction with a cashier or running into a neighbor at a store or even going to grab the same item off of a shelf at the same time really gave you that kind of peripheral sense of community and togetherness that really isn't happening now.
So it is perhaps an opportune time for a new book about relationships and community. It's called Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World. The author is Dr. Vivek Murthy. He was a U.S. Surgeon General from 2014 to 2017. He joins us from Miami. Dr. Murthy, thanks so much for joining us. When you write in the book that when you became Surgeon General, you expected to be talking a lot about the opioid addiction, about obesity, about the importance of immunizations. But then you went on a listening tour around the country and you heard a lot about loneliness.
That's right, John. I was really taught by people I met all across America and really across the world about how behind so many of the stories of addiction and violence and chronic illness that exists in society, and there were deep threads of loneliness that I was finding. And this is true whether I was talking to young people or old people, whether I was talking to members of Congress or to farmers in the Midwest. And it struck me. It reminded me of my own experiences as a child struggling with loneliness. It reminded me of my experience as a doctor caring for so many patients who came into the hospital alone and had nobody with them, often even at the time of death. And what I came to realize was that loneliness was very common, with more than 20% of adults in the United States struggling with loneliness, but it was also very consequential for our health, with people with loneliness standing to have an increased risk of heart disease, of dementia, depression, anxiety, and even premature death.
There's a correlation between loneliness and those conditions, but is there a more direct link?
Well, that's a good question. And the research on loneliness is evolving, but we have reasons to believe that loneliness very well may, in fact, have a direct impact on our health. And one of the reasons has to do with the physiologic impact that loneliness has on the body. What it does is it places the body in a stress state. And in the short term, that can be okay, because feeling lonely in the short term may nudge you to call a friend or to drop by and visit family. And in that sense, it can be helpful as a signal, just like hunger or thirst. The problem is when that stress state persists for a long period of time. And like many other forms of stress, it can lead to increased inflammation in our body, which can increase our risk of heart disease and other chronic illnesses.
Let me ask you about the current situation. We heard from our viewers some real emotion there about what's going on now. On the one hand, you were the top public health officer of the United States, and I assume you agree that we need to stay apart to try to fight this virus and to slow its spread. But on the other hand, you're saying that there is a problem, that there are problems that come from isolation and loneliness. How do you sort of balance those two and reconcile those two?
Well, I'm glad you asked, John, because this is an extraordinarily difficult moment for so many people whose lives have been turned upside down. And one of the most painful parts of it has been not being able to see people, not just our family or friends, but even strangers in our life, being able to sit next to strangers in a coffee shop, appreciate people who might be walking down the sidewalk with you. We value these now perhaps more than ever before. While there are impacts on our health of loneliness, in the short term, it's important for us to protect ourselves against COVID-19 during this pandemic. But we also shouldn't assume that because we have to be physically separated from each other, that we have to be socially distant. And the way that we can preserve our social connections in this time, I have to do with very simple steps, I believe, that we can take. We can, number one, ensure that we're spending at least 15 minutes a day reaching out to people that we love via video conference or phone. We can make sure that the quality of time that we have with people is high, and we can do that by reducing the distraction that we have when we talk to them, putting our phone away and other technology. We can also reach out to people with an intention to serve. I learned when writing this book that one of the most powerful antidotes to loneliness is service. And if we look around us right now, we'll recognize that many of us are struggling, and service can be checking on a neighbor to make sure they're okay, calling a friend to see how they're doing, having food delivered to a work colleague who might be struggling to telework while homeschooling their kids. There is a possibility that this experience with COVID-19 could lead to a deepening of our loneliness, to a social recession. But I believe that we can take this as an opportunity to create a social revival, to refocus on our relationships, to recommit to the people in our life, And if we do that, then I think we can come out of this pandemic stronger and more connected to each other, more healthier than ever before.
The book is Together. The author, Dr. Vivek Murthy. Dr. Murthy, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Sean. Good to be with you.
One thing among many that COVID has taught us is how we may need to recalibrate our expectations and our imaginations. Tonight, author Kelly Corrigan shares her humble opinion and projects what it will be like when a corner is turned.
Sometimes, when I feel outmatched by the thing in front of me, I do a mental exercise. I tell myself the story of what happened as if it's over, and I nailed it. This morning, I waited for 54 minutes to check out from the Safeway. The woman in front of me, whose hair and makeup was perfect, had 7 bottles of Martini and Rossi vermouth. That's it. And the guy in front of her had a full face, double ventilator gas mask. And I felt outmatched by the thing in front of me. So right there, I told myself the story of the pandemic of 2020 and how we nailed it. My success fantasy went like this. At first, it was awful. Nothing but bad news on top of bad news. But then we rose up. We made soups and stews for old people and dropped them off so they felt included and secure and nourished. We read books to children over the internet.
We stepped outside at the end of the day and played music and clapped so that each of us knew we were not alone.
We sent pizzas and Chinese food to ERs to sustain both our hospitals and our restaurants. We called old friends and told them things we'd forgotten to say. I miss you. I still think of you. Remember that time? We turned up, all of us, on our screens to keep businesses afloat, and in so doing, we're exposed to the more tender elements of our colleagues' lives. Pets and children were now, to our mutual benefit, in the frame. People figured out they didn't need fancy equipment to exercise. We stopped flying around and jumping in cars for no reason. Everyone planted things they could eat. We played cards with our families. We had long conversations. We identified what kind of learning can be delivered online. We discovered that teaching is the most complex, high-impact profession known to man, and we started compensating our teachers fairly for their irreplaceable work. Everyone voted after coronavirus.
Kids who lived through the virus valued science above all. They became researchers and doctors, kicking off the greatest period of world positive discovery and innovation the planet has ever seen.
We came, finally and forever, to appreciate the profound fact of our shared humanity and relish the full force of our love for one another.
Thank you, Kelly Corrigan, and wouldn't it be wonderful if all of that came true? And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.